done in this little slideshow is put together some slides that I...
He's recording now.
Oh, okay. Some slides and things that I took in Egypt and some lessons I learned. And like I said, it helped me understand the Bible better. And so I'm hoping that this will also, if we just kind of go through this, maybe give you a greater insight into the Bible and help us understand some of the things we read. Okay, so I really don't know anything about Egypt. Okay, it's very complicated. And so you may have questions afterwards. And, oh, what about this and what about that? I don't know. This is really Egypt by a dummy. I just picked up the surface of this, okay? Egyptology and the history of Egypt is extremely complicated, and scholars still argue about it. So I don't profess to understand all of this. I'm just going to go and pick up some of the things that I learned, and hopefully it'll help you understand a little bit better, too. All right, so this is a picture of Egypt. And, oh, there's a laser. Okay, good. Okay, so this is the Nile. This is the Nile River. And this is the Nile Delta. And it's interesting that this is actually Lower Egypt. We would think that would be Upper Egypt because it's up north. But it's not. It's Lower Egypt because it's downhill. So this is where the Nile enters in, runs into the sea. So this is Lower Egypt and this is Upper Egypt. And, of course, over here is Mount Sinai. And there's the Dead Sea over there. So just a couple of things, and I'm going to go back to other maps as we go along, but this is just to give you an idea, okay? This is the land of Goshen, remember, where the Israelites settled when they came in under Jacob, and where they became a great nation before they were slaves here in Goshen. And, of course, this is where they traveled, and we're going to come back to this, down here to Mount Sinai. They had to go through the wilderness of Sin. And now, interesting here, on the east side of the Nile River, that's where the Egyptians built their temples, because that's where the sun rises. And over here, on the west side, that's where all the pyramids and things like that are located, and all the tombs, because that's on where the sun sets, of course. And so, when we're going to be referring back to this, but I wanted to see this kind of a map, because it really gives you a real overview of Egypt. And this is one of the reasons Egypt became such a great and powerful and advanced nation, because they were protected. Back in those days, okay, you got an ocean on this side, you got a desert here, and a desert here, and a desert down here, unless you're coming up the Nile Valley. So there was no easy way to get to Egypt. They were well protected and isolated. So that's one reason it gave them a chance to develop such a strong and powerful culture, because they weren't constantly being attacked by their enemies, at least in the early days. So that's just some things to think about as we go through this. All right. Now, the Nile River is the very heart of Egypt, and that's what you've got to remember. Everything revolves around the Nile River. They could not exist without the Nile River. In fact, this is how they determined what taxes you paid. They had a Nilometer. And so every year, if it makes sense, the more flooding there was, the more crops you could plant, and therefore the more taxes you had to pay. So this is just that. It's a big well, and they would measure how far the water came up when the Nile flooded, and then they would determine your taxes by how much water there was. Now, so that helps you understand, right, in Exodus the 7th chapter, verse 20, why it was such a big deal when all the water in the Nile was turned to blood. Because, if you will, that was the very lifeblood of their nation. And so by symbolically turning it to blood, God is saying, I have control of the very thing you depend on for your lives. I control the Nile River. It is your literal lifeblood, and it's, well, figurative, if you will, figurative lifeblood, yet I control it, and I can turn it to blood. And so that's why that was such a powerful miracle, because everything depends on the Nile. Now, I handed out, that is so confusing, isn't it? It just want to make your head explode. So I tried to give you a simplified little timeline. only because I'm going to be talking about a lot of history and stuff, and you can look back at this. Oh, now, wait a minute. When did that happen? When did Abraham? When was Moses? It just kind of helps you put things in perspective, that's all. Because, you know, Egypt was around as a major empire for a long time, really up until even after Alexander the Great and the Romans. We're talking about, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 years of history here. So it's very complicated in a very long time. Okay, so I want to start off by talking about the oldest building in the world, the Saqqara Pyramid in Egypt. And so this was built around 2648 B.C. And a couple of interesting things about this building. You'll notice it's a stepped pyramid, right? The Egyptians didn't start off building those fancy, nice pyramids like this. They had to learn how to build the pyramid. So first they started off like this. And then there's another pyramid, it's called the Bent Pyramid. It looks like this. It looks like a two-year-old trying to build it with blocks, with Legos or something. And so it always drives me crazy when I hear people on, you know, the History Channel, well, we don't know how they did that, so UFOs and space aliens obviously came down and told people how to build pyramids. Well, that's stupid. You can tell the Egyptians had to learn how to build pyramids, and they made mistakes. And so it's there, and it's history. So when people say that, it's just foolishness. But anyway, the point of this is, it's right here. It's on the east side, west side of the Nile, because it's a tomb. And, oh, right there. Well, I'm sorry, I don't know why it's not advancing. Oh, there we go. I'm pointing the wrong way. All right, so Israel entered Egypt about 1870 B.C., and so I want you to think about it. This building had been standing for 800 years by the time that Joseph becomes the second in power, and then Jacob comes in and settles in the land of Goshen. This building had already been there for 800 years. So this was already a major civilization. And the Jews were what? They were sheep herders. They were goat herders. They were just shepherds living nomadic lifestyle. This was a major civilization. And here's some camel police in the ruins. And so here are these pyramids. The Great Pyramid, that's over there. I know it's the furthest away, but that's the biggest. It was built by Khufu, who is a pharaoh. And then his son built what's called the Khafre Pyramid. And then his son built the Menkaure Pyramid. So when you hear about the Great Pyramids, that's those of them right there that you hear about all the time. Now, the point is, Moses was born about 1,000 years after these pyramids were built. Now, I want you to just kind of think about that for a minute. That these pyramids had been standing for 1,000 years by the time Moses was born. So Egypt was a great nation, right? And so here are the pyramids up here by Cairo. And there. Okay. So each one of these blocks weighs about 5,000 pounds. And in the Great Pyramid, there's about 2.3 million of these blocks. And we still don't know exactly how they built it. So Egypt was a great and powerful nation when Moses was born and the Hebrews were slaves. This is the Khafre Pyramid, looking up at it. And you have to understand, it didn't look like what we think it does. These things were covered in white limestone and topped with gold on the top. So you can imagine, the pyramid is overwhelming as it is, but it's covered in pure white limestone. It's got a gold top on it, and you're a shepherd wandering in out of the desert, and you see something like this. This was a great and powerful nation. And here comes Moses. Now, I want you to think about this. Moses was raised among this, but then he goes away, of course, and he becomes a shepherd. He runs away after he kills the Egyptian. And he comes back, and his people are slaves. And he goes to the ruler of this nation that built these pyramids and is standing for 1,000 years and says, "My God wants you to let these people go." Right. The Pharaoh would have said, "What? Are you kidding? You're a bunch of slaves. Do you see what my gods have done? I rule over the most advanced civilization in the world, and it's been standing for 1,000 years, and a shepherd comes and tells me to let the slaves go. Well, of course the Pharaoh is not going to do that. You know, he's going to think that's a joke. And so that's the kind of thing that Moses was up against. All right, and by the way, there are bunches of pyramids in Egypt. There's not just those three. There's over 100. There's some off in the distance right there. I didn't know that. There's lots and lots of pyramids in Egypt. But we just think of the main three. Okay, the Great Sphinx was built by that other pharaoh who built one of the pyramids, Khafre. And now what I want you to show you on this is you can see some of the original paint. So these buildings and all these monuments were painted up. This was red and yellow and all kinds of colors. And so again, Egypt isn't what we think about it, where it's all sand colored, right? It's all gray. No, these things were bright and colorful, and all the temples were painted. And so it would have been a very, very different place than what we think about. And there's the rear end of the Sphinx. I just wanted to show that because you always see it in the front, so that's what it looks like in the back. There's this tail. You always see the face, but you never get to see the tail of the Phoenix, of the Sphinx. Anyway, so the people who live there now are Arabs. They are not Egyptians. They are not the people who built the pyramids. And as Farrell Deacon said, they're just the keeper of the pyramids. Now, they might like you to think that their civilization built the pyramids, but they didn't. The Egyptian people who built all the pyramids, they're gone. The people who live there now are Arabs, and they have nothing to do with the ancient Egyptians or the building of the pyramids. This is downtown Cairo, and I show you this to show that, I mean, basically, there are apartment buildings built out of mud brick, and it kind of thinks, well, what's really changed, you know, since the Egyptians, the Israelites were there. So it's a crowded, poverty-stricken city, even though it's a major city in the world. And one experience I had is we're driving in this big air-conditioned bus on this highway, and it's crowded, and you know, and they don't have very wide shoulders, and we stop on this highway, and right there, literally sitting on the shoulder of the road on a highway, I mean like I-95, that's what I'm talking about, like a highway like I-95, there's a woman sitting with her, you know, her legs crossed, with a little piece of cloth in front of her, and she's selling things like pieces of chewing gum and trinkets, right, to maybe people who are driving on this highway. And so I thought about that. What if your job was sitting by I-95 in rush hour, I mean literally inches from the car, and what you're hoping to do is sell a few pieces of chewing gum to support your family. And so I'm looking down at her, and she looks up at me and she smiles. And I thought, wow, if she can smile and have that kind of life, who am I to ever complain about my life? Where we have it so good in this country, and all we do is complain and complain and complain because we're not getting enough free stuff, right? And yet we have so much in this country, and that we take it for granted. So it's good to travel and see the poverty of other places to realize how lucky we are in this country and how generous we should be. And this is just a street scene in Cairo. This is very common in the mornings, the men gathering at these street places. Now, this is a taxi. And the taxi, this guy right here has a copy of the Quran. And I asked him if I could look at it, so I opened it and took this picture. And what I want you to understand is, obviously, not every Muslim is a terrorist. But they take their religion very seriously. I noticed a lot of Muslim men had this spot right on their forehead. And I thought, what is that? I know Hindus do that third eye thing. And Catholics, you know, during Lent, they get the ash put on their forehead. But what are these Muslim men with this spot on their forehead? What's that? Then somebody told me, because you only see it on the older men. It's from years and years and years of bowing down on their prayer rugs 3 times a day and touching their foreheads to the prayer rug. And after years and years and years of that, you get a callus on your forehead. Now that's devotion. I don't have calluses on my knees from praying. Do any of us? So my point is, that we need to understand that these people take their religion seriously. Maybe the way the Pilgrims and the Puritans first did when they came to America. And so it's hard for Americans to understand, yeah, when you make fun of their God, they're going to be offended. Maybe the way the Puritans would have been back 200 or 300 years ago. And so I'm not suggesting that Christians go out and, you know, kill people who make fun of Jesus. But if we took it seriously, maybe those people would be so socially ostracized and there would be such an outcry that they wouldn't do it again. But in this country, it's hard for us to understand that, yes, they take their religion seriously. It means something to them. It's part of their daily lives. And unfortunately, in large part, we've lost that in America. All right, then we took a trip down the Nile, and that was fascinating to see how people still live along the Nile. And as Farrell Deacon said, this could very well have been 2,000 years ago, that people were living in these mud brick houses by the Nile, washing their clothes, bathing, watering their animals, all along the Nile, very much like they probably were doing 2,000 years ago. And this is the kind of scenes you see. All right, then we went to the Valley of the Kings. Now, when they stopped building pyramids, maybe it was too expensive, I don't know, probably for every king to have a pyramid, they started building their tombs, the pharaohs, in the Valley of the Kings. And one reason they think they chose this is because, look, this looks like a pyramid. So maybe that's why they used this area. And the Valley of the Kings is way down here. This is where King Tut is buried. You've all heard of him, right? King Tut? That's where he's buried, in the Valley of the Kings. And this is the kind of thing they would do. They would burrow into the side of the mountain and make their tomb that way. Now, I want to talk about one particular person that's buried here, or was. They don't know where her mummy is now. But this woman named Queen Hatshepsut, who some think is the adopted mother of Moses. Now, no one knows for sure. But she lived about the time. She reigned from 1504 to 1482 B.C., the time. And so she would have been a girl about the time Moses was born. Now, she's interesting because you're thinking, wait a minute, I thought only pharaohs ruled Egypt. And they did. What happened is, she was the queen, and she had a son. But her husband, the pharaoh, died suddenly. So she took over because her son was too young to rule. So she took over. And she became a very, very powerful queen, and she ruled as pharaoh until her son became old enough. Now, after that, we don't know if she was assassinated or what exactly happened to her, but she disappeared, and her son completely destroyed her temple. This is a rebuilt, what it would have looked like. This is rebuilt from the plans that they had. But it was completely destroyed by her son. But the point is that some believe that she may have been the adopted mother of Moses. And from that, I want to say that, remember, Moses had all this wealth and this power, and you see these magnificent tombs. And what does it say about Moses? He refused to be called her son, considering the approach of Christ greater than all the riches of Egypt. You have to understand that Egypt was a rich place. It was the most powerful nation on earth and had been for a long time. That's what Moses gave up to be identified with slaves. And so once you see all this wonder and this power and this beauty, you realize how much Moses really gave up. And then how much God requires of us to follow him. That actually we're not required to give up anything here of what Moses did, just a little bit, compared to what Moses had to give up. Now I want to show you something else, just interestingly. This is Queen Hatshepsut here. This is one of her statues. But look at this, she has a beard on. What's with that? Well, she wore a false beard to be the pharaoh. So Queen Hatshepsut put on a fake beard in order to act as the pharaoh. And she's also known for building these obelisks. Now this is an engineering marvel in itself. That's a solid piece of granite. A solid piece. And they cut it out miles away, and then they transported it, and then they lifted it upright. And again, nobody even knows how they did that. But this is the kind of thing that, what does that look like? Well, the Washington Monument. Washington Monument is modeled on the obelisks that Queen Hatshepsut designed. So think of it this way. We in America chose to honor our greatest president by remembering a queen who wore a false beard. That's an interesting way of thinking about it. Okay, so now very quickly, we went to a bunch of temples, and one of them is Karnak. which was built over a long, over hundreds of years by as many as 30 pharaohs. And it's down here on the east side. Okay, and so there's the entrance into it. And one of the things I noticed was the construction. It's these bricks made of mud and straw, just like we read about when the Israelites made mud and straw bricks. So this, we know that's historically accurate, that that happened. This is how they made columns. And what's interesting, remember this, it says Moses was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians, right? So back in those days, where did they do the teaching? In the temples. The temples were the places of teaching and instruction. So when we're walking through some of these temples that were around in the days of Moses, you suddenly realize, wait, this is the main temple, and Moses was educated in the temple, so I could be in a temple where Moses walked. And that just kind of sends chills up your spine, doesn't it? This is a picture of our group sitting at the base of a pillar in the Temple of Karnak. And all of a sudden I thought, maybe Moses sat at the base of this pillar. And so it just has a very strong, you know, it's an emotional feeling to think you might be in a place and touching a place where somebody like Moses was. And again, to think of that Moses had the top line education. He lived in the most beautiful, extensive places in the world. He had the greatest education in the world. And he gave all that, add that up, to identify with a bunch of slaves. Okay, a column shaped like a bunch of papyrus. All right, and I just want to notice the hieroglyphics. If you were like me, maybe you always thought they just, you know, carved hieroglyphics directly into stone. They didn't. What they did was they would coat something, a wall, with a sheet of plaster, and then they would etch it into the plaster, and then someone else would come along and paint it. So hieroglyphics, because they're so complicated, weren't directly carved into stone. They were carved into plaster on top of the stone. Now, there are a couple of things we saw, some historical things that are important to note, I think. This is a king, a pharaoh named Merneptah. Yeah, that's it, something like that. And we do know for a fact that there's a stone in which there's an inscription that talks about him attacking the Israelites. Now, this isn't it, but if you see there's a king here, there's a prone body right here, and there's somebody walking on it. So we do know for a fact, as a historical fact, that this guy did attack the Israelites. And on this inscription, they think what it shows is him trampling on his enemies, the Israelites. Now you might say, well, okay, what's the point of that? The point is that over the years, the Bible has been attacked for not being historically accurate. But when we look into the Bible, we find that there are historical places and historical people like we expect to find if the Bible is true. Let me give you another couple examples. There's a pharaoh named Tutmosis, who may or may not have been the pharaoh of the Exodus. We don't know for sure. But in these things, he likes to show all the... This is a captive. See, his arms are bound. And there's this row and row and rows, because he's a pharaoh and he's bragging about what a great guy he is, of everybody he held captive or ruled over. And something under his control is Jacob L. and Joseph L. And so it seems to be a reference to the Israelites. And again, now this is interesting. This is King Shishak, or Pharaoh Shishak, sorry, Pharaoh Shishak. And this is a wall dedicated to all his great exploits. But he's mentioned by name in 1 Kings 14:25 as coming up and attacking Jerusalem. Now, again, you may say, okay, that's all well and interesting, but what's the point? The point is, you compare the Bible to its ancient history to something, say, like the Book of Mormon. You look at the Book of Mormon, and it talks about people and places that don't exist, that people never heard of, that you can't confirm by archaeology. But then you open the Bible, and it's like, oh, it says Pharaoh Shishak came and attacked the temple. Well, there really was a Pharaoh Shishak. Okay? So we can look at the Bible and see that it's historically accurate, and hopefully that increases our faith. Again, unlike things like the Book of Mormon, that when you open it and you read the stories And there's supposed to be giant tribes of Jews living in North America that no one can ever find any evidence of. Hope you would doubt the Book of Mormon. But with the Bible, we know this is historically accurate. Okay, just a couple of other things. We saw this Temple of Edfu that was built when the Greeks and the Romans ruled over Egypt. It's down here. But what I want to show you is this. Inside the Temple of Edfu, they have an ark. In the back, in the back section of the temple, in the Holy of Holies, if you will, much like the tabernacle. And so this was built many thousands of years after this particular temple, after the tabernacle. So it makes you wonder if the Egyptians were borrowing from the Jews. Now I want to show you this. This is a picture in the Temple of Edfu. This is the god Horus giving life, the symbol of Ankh. You've all heard that, right? It's supposed to show life. He's feeding life to the Pharaoh. He's giving life to the Pharaoh. Well, these temples were sometimes used by Christians. Later Christians moved in, and so what they would do is they defaced the temple. Oops. They defaced this. Here, they just chipped away the face of the Pharaoh. And notice they didn't tear up the whole thing. They just chipped away the faces. Because here they were using it as a church, if you will, and here the pagan gods are showing giving life. And of course, they believed only Jesus Christ could give us life. The Temple of Philo, down here, in the very tip. And I just want to show here, the early Christians carved away the face of this pagan god to put in a cross, as you see right here, to show that this was now a church. Okay, this just shows this is where the southernmost point of the Roman Empire was, at this temple. All right, so very quickly then, we go into the land of Goshen. And this is the area where Jacob entered and settled up here. And, okay, so it's important to realize when you call it the best of the land. Well, why? Because it's green and fertile. And you can really, once you've seen the land of Goshen and you've seen all the rest of Egypt, you understand why this was such a great place to live. Now, this is one of those places, this is Succoth, when they exited Egypt, and this is the first night they camped and celebrated the Feast of Unleavened Bread. I don't know if we stopped, and Pharaoh Jenkins says this is Succoth, so I take his word on it. But anyway, this is where that occurred. These are pigeon houses. I just thought that was interesting along the way. These are some photos of people in this area in Goshen. That's what it looks like, crowded cities. All right, so now they're going to go from Goshen, right? So when they leave, during the Exodus, they're going to go from Goshen down to Sinai. And I was lucky to go to Mount Sinai. Not everyone was on the tour, but I was lucky enough to go. And this is probably the part of the tour that opened my eyes the most. I know we're way over, and I'll be very quick. But I want you to see this. This is the land of Goshen. I want to get it clear in your mind. It's green. It's fertile. It's well watered. And God's going to lead you out of this land where you're a slave into the promised land, right? So you go from this to that. It's dry. It's hot. It's probably over 100 degrees. You're wearing sandals. You've got rocks in your shoes. There's nothing to drink. It's blinding because this is just white desert. You know, the kids are complaining. There's nothing to give your sheep and your goats. And do you wonder why then the whole congregation grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness? At least I like to think, oh no, if I was one of those and I had seen the great miracles God performed, and then he wanted to take me through the wilderness, that would be just fine with me. I wouldn't have complained. But after you've been out in that 2 or 3 weeks or a couple of months, do you think you might have started complaining a little bit? Right? And so it helps you understand why they grumbled and complained against Moses even after they had just seen all those great miracles. Now, this is another scene. We saw some wild camels out there. You see the camel? There he is. Perfectly blended in for his environment. And that's the other thing. Look, this is the feet of the camel. You see, they're made for walking in the sand when they step down. See how big their pad is? Oops. So they can walk in loose sand. And they're perfectly adapted. They have ears turned backwards, their noses are slits, they have long eyelashes. They're perfectly adapted for living in the desert. Now, you believe either one of two things. You believe that about 6 billion years ago, There was a random explosion for no reason, and out popped mainly hydrogen atoms. And over several billion years, these hydrogen atoms randomly collided into each other until eventually a camel fell out. That just happened to be perfectly adapted for living in the desert. Or you believe that there was a God who said, I'm going to create a world for people to live in, and I'm going to make all kinds of different habitats, and I'm going to create different animals to live in these habitats, and I'm going to make them perfectly adapted to live there. That's what you believe. One of those two things, and it is that simple. That camels came about by a divine mind who created and perfectly adapted for the environment, or it happened by random chance of hydrogen atoms sliding into each other in a universe that doesn't care. That's how everything came about, one of those two ways. Okay, so very quickly here we saw some other things. Now we don't know for sure this is, you know, the well where Moses turned the bitter water to sweet, but it would have looked like something like that. We saw the plain of Paran and the area where Moses lifted up his arms to defeat the Amalekites. And again, it would have looked something very much like this. All right, we went on to Mount Sinai. There's the very top. There's a church up there in a mosque, because if there's a church, there's got to be a mosque, you know, to show that they're not, you know, that they're equal. And that's what it looks like at sunrise. Very beautiful. And here's where Elijah supposedly hid from Jezebel when she was trying to kill him. But again, it would have looked something like this. Now, this is what I really want you to show you. This is the bottom of Mount Sinai. This is where, supposedly, or an area like this, where the children of Israel would have camped while Moses was up on Mount Sinai. A great open plain, and Mount Sinai is up here on this side. And so, at least it gives you an idea of what it would have been like. Now, of course, we don't know exactly for sure where they were, but they even have a little monument showing that's where the golden calf was. You know, and they don't know that for sure. But that's just how people are. But anyway, inside the sanctuary, St. Catherine's Monastery, I want to show you this. This is supposedly the burning bush. The burning bush, right? Now, this is the most crazy thing in the whole trip of Egypt. Do you notice anything wrong with this picture? They have a fire extinguisher. I always thought, if the burning bush starts burning again, like, are they going to put it out? You know? Maybe it's God again. I don't know. But anyway, I always thought that was really funny. Why do you have a fire extinguisher next to the burning bush? So, anyway, it's just interesting that some of these things we know for sure where they are, and then some of them, you know, are just speculation. Okay, we're almost done. I want to talk to you quickly about Abu Simbel, which was a tomb built by Ramses II, and it was completely covered by sand and not rediscovered until the mid-1800s. Now, I'll tell you why this is important, just very quickly. One of the things back in the 1800s that people used to criticize the Bible for is the Bible mentioned a great tribe of people called the Hittites, a great nation of people called the Hittites, but there was no archaeological evidence for it. And so people used to say, well, this you can't trust the Bible because it talks about this great nation of Hittites, and no one's ever heard of them. There's no archaeological evidence for it. Well, when they rediscovered the tomb of Ramses II, Abu Simbel, and they went inside and they dug out all the sand, well, guess what? Inside, they found a great mural depicting Ramses II fighting the Hittites. So finally, there was archaeological proof after, you know, 1,800 years that the Bible was correct, and what it said was correct. And so when people criticize the Bible for not being historically accurate, well, you can't trust it, you know, because it's not real. Well, things like this help confirm our faith. All right, so just a quick things I learned, and this is it. We are wealthy beyond our imagination in this country, and we often think it. The Bible is based on history. It records the stories of real people in real places, unlike things like the Book of Mormon. This book, the Bible is based on history, and we need to remember that and have our faith grounded in that. It's real. It's not made up. It's not a myth. It's not a legend. It's not a story we tell our kids. It's real. It's history. God expects us to walk by faith like Moses and give up the short-term pleasures and turns long for the long-term reward. Whether it's Moses or the children of Israel that had to walk through the desert to get to Canaan, that's what God expects of us. God's glory is all around us if we'll just look. And God can bring low even the most powerful nation. He did it to Egypt, and he can certainly do it to us unless we become a righteous nation. All right, if anybody wants to see the photos, I have them up on my Flickr website. So I appreciate your attention this morning. I know we went way long, and I appreciate your patience with me. But the point is, I hope that maybe we've learned some things from from this that maybe will help us understand the Bible a little bit more. Specifically, that if you're living in sin, and God, if you're living as a slave to sin, and God promises you salvation, yet you shouldn't get to the promised land, but you might have to walk through the desert to get there. That when you turn your back on sin, it's going to be hard, and it may not be easy. There is something greater waiting for you in the promised land, in the end. If we'll just have the faith to keep going and not give up. So whether you're here this morning and you haven't started, or you're here this morning and you're thinking about giving up, I hope you'll think about that as we stand and sing our closing song.
When we walk with the Lord in the light of His Word, what glory He sheds on our way. While we do His good will, He aligns with us still. Always be engaged in
growing in your word, changing. Father, we pray that you would help us to be mindful of those around us who are lost. That you would be eager and excited to share your word with them, to share Bible stories with them, to share the story of salvation, Father, in Jesus. And we just pray that you'd be all of us as we leave this place, and that you bring us back the next time we can, Father, in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you.